Give me a few minutes to adjust to the bright lights. My name is Keith, and I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, and I struggle with rejection and anger and addiction. Hey, that was my family. My forever family. They know what to say. They know how to do that. We do that every Monday night. That's how I'd introduce myself. And it's just one of the ways that we begin this journey together as we begin to identify what it is we struggle with. We do Celebrate Recovery every Monday night, and I want to tell you before I get started just a little bit, because I only get this opportunity once every 3 years, so since I get it, I'm going to take it, and I'm going to take it full advantage of it, and just tell you a little bit about Celebrate Recovery. We meet every Monday night. We have a full catered meal that is phenomenal every Monday night. We have free child care. We have the landing for our teens. In fact, this last Monday night, we had the most teens we've ever had. We had 30. We generally run around 20, 22. But we had 30 teens this last Monday night, which is extremely exciting. And the whole idea is with the kids and the teens, they have programming as well so that hopefully they can break the cycle of dysfunction and not repeat that into adulthood like us. We, on every Monday night, kind of have a rhythm where we teach one night recovery principles, and then the next week we would do a testimony of somebody who's worked through those 12 steps, those 8 principles, and have gotten healing. They've experienced some freedom from their hurts, habits, and hang-ups. And they share their testimony. It looks a lot like what we do on a Sunday morning. We have a 3-song worship set, and the only difference is I would say it's Sunday morning and Sunday night on steroids. Like we're a notch up. We bring it up because we celebrate our recovery from our hurts, habits, and hang-ups, and our recovery to Jesus Christ. So I really want you to come take a peek some Monday, check us out. After our large group celebration time, we have what we call open share groups, and that's where we kind of drill in a little bit deeper. In those open share groups, there's 20 specific open share groups. They're all gender specific and issue specific. It's always guys with guys, girls with girls, and then they're issue specific depending on whatever issue it is you struggle with. And so we try and have something for every issue. We basically start with a men's mixed group and a women's mixed group, and out of those mixed groups, as people share kind of what their struggle is, we will start new groups. And so we got groups for men like PTSD and anger. We've got addiction groups, sexual addiction groups. And you can go to those groups every Monday night. They also have, in the women's side, we've got an anger group for that. We've got a food issues group. And we've come to find out that a lot of women struggle with past abuse. So physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. So we have a group for that as well. So a lot of different groups. Encourage you to check in at the table afterwards. I'm going to be out there as well. Come by, and if you got any questions, hopefully I can answer some questions for you. And I'll just say, I'm going to give everybody a pass here, right? Because I know what happens. You leave here, and you see that table, and it's like Moses parted the waters. Everybody goes around the table. I want anybody to know that I struggle with something. I don't want to be one of those people. It's okay. Come for somebody else. Don't come for yourself. Like, come and ask questions about somebody else, like how this might help them, and then that way you got the pass. You can come. You don't have to go around the table. So I personally, let me get into the message. I personally my master's is in counseling, and I've got a history. I really started counseling. I first worked in a drug and alcohol rehab center back in the 80s. That was my first experience with that. And so I have over 30 years of experience in counseling, both from a professional side and from a personal side. To get into counseling, you have to go to counseling, right? That's a part of it. And currently, as of this last February, I'm back in counseling again. So I didn't get fixed yet. I'm still working on that. If you guys have any suggestions, I'm open to those. Like, I'm working on that. Didn't get my cured card yet. I'm going to keep going, though. My family, my forever family on Monday nights understands that. They know me a little bit more, right? But one of the things I've learned in this journey is that I have some aha moments in counseling. I want to share this one with you because this one was kind of the big one for me. Scott Britton, a counselor, shared this with me. He said, your problem is that you don't know what your problem is. You think your problem is your problem, and that's not your problem at all. Your problem is not your problem. That's your main problem. Okay? Just let that soak in for just a minute. Really what it means at the end of the day is that we spend a lot of time focusing on what we think the problem is, and it's really not the problem at all. And it happens to all of us because we have some past wounding in our life. We've had some tough relationship or some tough pieces in our life that we've struggled with. I'll kind of bring it home a little bit. This past spring, my wife and I decided we were going to do a project together. Is anybody married out here? Does anybody, do you succeed when you try and do projects with your spouse? Because I fail at it miserably, like over and over. Like I'm like, this time, all right, we're going to get it right this time. And it doesn't ever work out like I think it's going to work out. So we had this plan. We were going to do some yard work, right? And I mean, how hard can yard work be? We go purchase 55 bags of mulch and some plants and some different things, and we got this all set up. So I take the heavy work, right? I'm grabbing all the bags of mulch and I'm spreading them all over our beds and everything. And my wife, she's gone to work and she's down on her hands and knees and she's spreading the mulch out. So I got my headphones on. I'm in the work mode. I get done spreading mulch. And in my mind, I'm like she's really not doing that the best way. There's probably a better way to do that. Like she's on her hands and knees. I'm going to go make it a little easier. I'm going to go get a couple rakes and I'm going to help make this project work a little faster. So I go grab a couple rakes, I come over to where she's at, and I get one of these, like, in fast, right? She's like, making facial expressions and everything, and I'm like, remember, I told you I struggle with rejection and anger. So the message that I got when she was doing this was, I don't know what the heck I'm doing. She knew the better way to do it. And so I immediately went to my next emotion, which I really only have about two, anger. I'm in the front yard at my house, Pastor Keith, and I'm showing like all kinds of colors, like my ugly side, about spreading mulch. Like, you know, is there a right and wrong way to spread mulch? You really going to tell me how to spread mulch? I didn't even listen to what she had to say. It had nothing to do with that. What my wife was saying was, I'm almost done with this bed. Why don't we go over there and do this? But we never got to that because I don't do projects well together, right? I know the right way. And I went into this. And if you were here last week, the reason why, you understand why we go and why we struggle with that is this. My desire is I want to control things. And we're all the same in that way. We all share that commonality because it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden where original sin started. Check out this verse. This is God talking to Adam and Eve. After they had sinned, he simply says this, I'll sharpen the pain of your pregnancy, and in pain you will give birth. And you will desire to, say it with me, control your husband, and he will rule over you. Husbands, did any of you experience this? Wives? It's the reality that we all experience. It wasn't God's perfect plan. It was a result of the curse. This is a part of the curse all the way back in the garden. And now what you have is power struggle, right? You have husband wanting to control wife, wife wanting to control husband. This is what shows up, not just in a marital relationship, by the way. It shows up in every relationship, right? Your boss, your coworkers, your kids, your parents, whatever the relationship is, we all struggle with that. We all have this common denominator that we want to control. In fact, in the counseling world, everybody who shows up into my office struggles with three things around control. One is they want to control others. They want to control others. So when they come in, they won't start with, I have this issue, unless they say, I have this issue, and it's others. I'm trying to control their personality, their behavior, the things they're doing. I'm trying to control this, and I'm not doing real good at it. I'm failing at it. Or they might say this. I struggle with my circumstances. No matter how hard I try, like everything just keeps failing. And man, if I could just get my circumstances together, if my finances were just in better shape, if my neighbor would stop or my wife would start, then everything would be different. My circumstances would change. And sometimes we have this false belief that we can manage God, that we can control God. And this is where we become the gods of our universe. We want to control everything. We want to control people, we want to control others, and we want to control God. Now, at the end of the day, this is going to result in the same thing for all of us. You ready? Conflict and frustration. Conflict and frustration. That's the result of us trying to be God. Eric talked about this last week in a lot of detail. If you haven't listened to the message, I encourage you to go back and listen to that message because it's phenomenal about this desire for us to be gods. Now, we don't wake up at the beginning of the day and say, man, I'm going to figure out how I can be God today. I'm going to be the best God there ever was. Like, we don't wake up that way. But incrementally, when we take control from God and we want to be in control, that's what happens. And so what happens, we have to get past denial in our lives. We have to get past denial because denial is what puts us in that place of wanting to be God. When we're not ready to accept that our lives are unmanageable. Now, God has an antidote for denial. He has an antidote for denial. What is the antidote for denial? It's simply this. It's a four-letter word. Say it with me. Pain. Pain. Right? The reality is, we're not going to change until fear of pain or the fear of change is exceeded by pain. We're not going to change until the fear of change is exceeded by our pain level. So let me give you an illustration of this. My daughter and I went backpacking a couple summers ago, and we had hiked into the Appalachian Trail, which was straight up. We got there somewhere around in the early afternoon. We took a break, and then we decided we were going to hike the Appalachian Trail. And so we did some ridge walking, not real difficult, but at the end of the day, like, we were exhausted. I was exhausted. She probably did better than me as a teenager. I was exhausted. I was also carrying a lot more weight on my back than she was. Let's just be honest. So when I took that pack off, I put it down. I took my boots off. I mean, that's the best thing at the end of the day. You get your boots off, let your feet cool off. And I was sitting there getting my stove ready. I wanted to eat. That was the first thing I wanted to do. I have to eat. I have to get caloric intake. That was my main concern. And so I'm sitting there getting the stove ready, not really paying attention to anything. And my daughter begins to tell me that I need to move. And if you have teenage daughters or teenage sons, most of the time you just don't listen to that, right? Like, why would I listen to my daughter? I know better. And so she's telling me to move, and I'm not paying attention. I'm continuing doing what I'm doing. I'm exhausted. I have no desire to do anything different than what I'm doing. I'm going to eat. That's my only priority. And now she says it with a little bit more emphatically, with a little bit more urgency. She said, Dad, you need to move now. And so I look at her like I'm getting ready to correct her, and she's looking over here. She's not even looking at me. About 6 foot off the end of my feet was this thing hanging on the tree here. And it was rattling, 14 buttons on it. It was making all kinds of noise, and it was coming straight at me, like it was on a mission to come to me. I moved really quick. Like, all of a sudden, the exhaustion and the tiredness and the hunger that I had just went away, right? Because my fear to change was exceeded by my fear of pain. Does that make sense? In the counseling world, we call that shopping, right? I was shopping for new behavior. And God will allow those things. We call them denial busters. God will allow those things in our life. So there's three different denial busters that I'd like you to see. One is crisis. One is crisis. And some of you are in a crisis right now in your life. You're experiencing something that you just don't see any way out. You don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. Crisis. God will use that in our life to move us forward, to move us out of that pain. Because the reality is, when I'm just sitting on the rock and relaxing, I'm not looking for change in my life. And so we have to experience some form of crisis in our life. Sometimes God will use confrontation. And that's where people who love you and are willing to lean into your life are willing to become accountability partners for you and say, hey, boo, buddy, you're messing up. Boo, that's, sorry, that's my wife. It's one person gets that name. So things that come out of your mouth on stage. I'm worried about what else might come out, so... I get one shot at this, so. But hey, buddy, you're messing up, man. You're running your family into the ground. You're messing up your employment. You're getting ready to lose everything. Like, people who love you will come around you and they'll confront you about this need to change. So God will use that in our life, and sometimes God will use catastrophe. And we hope that nobody ever gets this point. In the recovery world, we talk about this as in the form of jails, institutions, and death, right? That's like the bottom. Like, you, the bottom falls out. There's no place else to go. When you get down that low, you're like, I don't know what else to do. Something has to change. And that's where we get to the place where Eric brought us last week is this, simply principle one. Realize, I'm not God. I'm not God. I need to do something different. I need to admit that I'm powerless to control my tendency to do the wrong thing, and that my life is unmanageable. Now, for the majority of us in here, like Eric talked about last week, right? Like, this series, this Life's Healing Choices series that we're in, is for a very narrow section of people, right? If you've never struggled with anything, this series is not going to apply to you. Like, it's just not going to work for you. And And so when we get to this place, we may say this. We may say, you know, I've never really been, my life's pretty manageable. I've never had any issues in my life to where it's been unmanageable. I was raised in a really good home. I had two good parents. They loved me. They nurtured me and took care of me. I've really had a good life with very little conflict. My life is really pretty manageable. And we call that denial. Because the reality is, we are a sinful people. And if you're in relationship with anybody, and I'm not even talking about a marital relationship, if you have a child, if you have a parent, if you're in a work relationship, you know that there are other sinful people in this world. If you drive in the city of Virginia Beach, you know that your life is unmanageable. Right? Like, reality check. So your life has moments of unmanageability. And the reality is, unless you're 100% submitted to God, 100% of the time, like 365, you're going to experience moments of unmanageability in your life. And you're going to need to God. You're going to need God to break you out of that denial and allow that in your life. So that's what we call the kind of the realization one. That's the, I'm going to recognize that I have a problem. This one is the one that I get to teach on, is the hope one. It's the hope one, which is earnestly believe that God exists, that I matter to him, and that he has the power to help me recover. So really just three parts. If you want to take notes, there's just three parts to this. You can take that statement, break it into three pieces. First one, step one, acknowledge God's existence. Acknowledge God's existence. And I would say, by and large, probably most everybody in here says, yeah, I know that there's a God. You may not be on the journey yet. You may not have crossed the line of faith. You may be still struggling with this God thing, but you recognize that God exists. And in fact, I'm 53 years old. I would say it's probably easier to believe in God today than it was 50 years ago. And the reason why is because science has revealed so much more to us. I mean, the universe, the vastness of the universe. I'll share with you. So I'm adopted. Many of you know that if you know me. And so in this adoption journey, for me, like, that's a part of where my rejection comes from. Like, I was given up as a baby. Why would somebody give me up? So I'm not going to tell you all my you know, I go to counseling for this, okay? I'm not going to tell you all this. But what I will tell you is that the struggle has been real. And so at 18, I started this journey to find my biological family. And at 28, after petitioning the court multiple times and the adoption agency, I finally got my records. I was able to contact and meet my maternal side of my family. Great times. We've been to family reunions together. They've been to my house. We've stayed at their house. Like, it's been great to find my maternal side. But over the last few years, my sister has done DNA testing, and she said, you know, you need to do the DNA testing. You need to find out who your dad is. And so in July, I did like 25 million other people have done, and I spit in a tube and mailed it off. I wanted to see what the DNA said about me, like who am I related to? And I found some cousins and stuff. It's like, it's been really cool. But let me tell you the cool part. Like, I'm going to bore you a little bit with the science of DNA. So in DNA, there's something that happens with all of us. There's these things called single nucleotide polymorphisms. We're just going to abbreviate that from here on out because I don't want to say that every time. SNPs, and basically they're building blocks in your genetic DNA. It takes about 1,000 combinations to make one of those. You and I have about 4 to 5 million different combinations in us, and there's over 100 million throughout the world of these different combinations that they have discovered. Let me just say that. Like, that's, I mean, 50 years ago, they didn't have this kind of stuff and this kind of technology. Today, like, they're running stuff against stuff. Like, literally, when I send my DNA off, as soon as they run it, they pop up all these cousins and stuff. Like, I've been in contact with a cousin, a sister, and an aunt as a result of my DNA testing. Like, first level. Still haven't found any paternal. They're on the maternal side, so we found some secrets out. And, yeah, we won't say any more about that. This is live. Erase that part out. So, a whole bunch of stuff. Now, when you think 100 million, like, I don't even get my mind around what 100 million is. Most of you wear a Fitbit, right? You track steps, and you want to get somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 a day, and that's what you do to stay healthy. If you took 10,000 steps a day for the next 27 years, you would hit that number of 100 million, just to give you an idea. That's how big our God is. And in fact, They only tested 700,000 of these SNPs in my system so that they could figure out like the connections. I'm like, they can figure out health, they figure out relationships, finger length, hair color, eye color. Like, it's crazy how much stuff they find out with DNA. You think that all just happened? You think that's just like random that happens? I think it's harder. It takes more faith to believe that randomly happens and that there's all those different codes. Like, and none of us are the same. That's how big our God is. Like, that just blows my mind. It's not hard, but the first step is we got to recognize that God exists. The second one is a little bit different, and this one's a little bit more of a challenge. The second one is this: realize that I matter to God. Realize that I matter to God. Now, this one has been tougher for me. Like I said, I struggle with rejection. So my default is that I don't matter to you, and I don't matter to God. And it takes time to develop trust for me. Like, I'm slow to develop trust as a result of that. I love the verse again. Let's read Hebrews 11 again. It says, without faith it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. So that word reward literally means that God left heaven and came down here. What a better reward that he sent Jesus Christ. That is our higher power to come here and to deliver us from whatever that struggle is, whatever that hurt, that habit, that hang-up is, to give us a do-over, to love us right where we are, unconditionally, like nobody else has the ability to do that. God does that in the person of Jesus Christ. I want you to know this about God. This is how much he cares about you. First of all, God knows about your situation. He knows about your situation. You may say, man, I'm living through some tough stuff right now. I don't know if I'm going to get my wife back. I don't know if I'm going to get my husband back. They're addicted. They're struggling. Whatever's going on. I want you to know that God knows about your situation, and he cares. He didn't wake up today and go, oh, man, I totally missed that. How did I miss that? God not only knows about your situation, he cares. Secondly, God cares about your situation. I just said that. 1 Peter 5:7, and I love this verse because Peter, more than anybody, understood how God cares because he lived with him. 1 Peter says this: cast all your anxiety on him. Even if you have anxiety about preaching up here, cast all of that anxiety on him because he cares for you. Peter was one of the three, right? He was one of the inner circle. Peter, James, and John, they went everywhere with Jesus. They experienced nearly every miracle he did. In fact, the three of them experienced two miracles that nobody else did, the walking on the water and the transfiguration. Peter, of all people, he was the one who stepped out of the boat and walked on water. Peter knew how much Jesus cared, and he was able to write that verse. I don't want you to forget that. And the third thing is that God can change me and my situation. Now, this is why this is the hope principle. He can change me and my situation. And by the way, sometimes he'll change both of those things. Sometimes he'll change me and sometimes my situation. And in the recovery world, we say this: don't quit before the miracle. Don't quit before the miracle, because God is going to do a work. He wants to do that. Like, when you pray that God does that, it's never easier to pray in God's will when you ask God for the miracle in your life to change you and to change your situation. God wants the best for us. He wants that in our lives. I love what the author Paul says this in Ephesians chapter 1. He said, I pray that you'll begin to understand how incredibly great his power is to help those who believe in him. The same power that raised Christ from the dead. That, to me, gives me hope, because I think about, if God can raise Jesus Christ from the dead, like, that's a pretty incredible feat. To raise somebody from the dead. He can raise your dead relationship. He can resurrect your relationship at your job. He can resurrect your finances. Like, God can put life into whatever it is that you're struggling with. Now, we have hundreds of people that I could share their story with today, just to have them prayed up here and share how God has done a miracle in their life. But I've asked Joni to share her story, and she would have been live today, but she's on her honeymoon. And she's going to be the one who is helping us start Grace Norfolk in October 15th. They're kicking off out there. Super excited about that. But I want her to share her story so that you can see how this principle played out in her life.
Hi, my name is Joni. I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, and I struggle with anger and addiction. The biggest secret in my family growing up was my father's struggle with alcohol. He was a living Jekyll and Hyde. Nicest guy in the world when he wasn't drinking. But once he started drinking, he became a mean, manipulative, and abusive person. I knew from an early age my family wasn't normal. But I was too young to really understand just how far from normal we really were. As a young girl, my family was very involved in our church. Everything we did was within the walls of that building and with the people of that church. It was a safe place for me. When my parents divorced in the early 1970s, our church and the people in it became anything but safe. I was treated badly by my friends because being from a broken home in the early 1970s was not common, and I was very different from them. Friends' parents refused to let me play with them, and I was picked on and abused by other kids. And I didn't feel like anyone at home could or would help me, so I kept quiet about it, more secrets. I was about 12 years old when I was given the choice to stop going to church. And I did just that. The rejection, the betrayal, and the hurt from the way I was treated convinced me that all churches and all church people were just hypocrites and liars. Being a bit of an outcast and a rebel at that, I went out and found other kids like me, those from broken homes and troubled families. And by the age of 13, I started drinking and drugging to find some sense of belonging, community anywhere. God wasn't any part of that world, and I was doing just fine without him. By the time I was 15, I was a teenage runaway, living on my own in the streets of Boston, Massachusetts. During this time, I fell into some pretty rough crowds. And I experienced way too many things a 15-year-old girl should never have to experience. Alcohol became a huge struggle for me in my mid-30s. And despite my fear of God, of church and church people, I managed to get and stay sober through the help of secular recovery. I spent 14 years seeking a relationship with a higher power, any other higher power than Jesus, because I had already summed him up in a big way when I was a kid. And I was convinced he was not going to be my answer. I resisted any mention of church or following Christ. During that time, I hadn't realized it, but Jesus started revealing his plans for me by placing a couple of really amazing Christian men and women in my path. Between recovery meetings and coworkers, they kept showing up. This was the first time I was open to hearing about Jesus and the good side of religion. These men and women lived and breathed their love of Christ and it became very attractive to me. I started giving him another chance, and somewhat skeptical, I opened my mind just a little bit. I started attending Grace at Norfolk Campus as part of this seeking journey. And when they did the series on life's healing choices a few years back, I quickly discovered that Grace and Celebrate Recovery was a safe place to explore, research, and decide if maybe I'd been wrong all those years, kicking all those religious people out of my life. Through attending Celebrate Recovery and joining a step study group early on, I was introduced to the Bible teachings and the Word of God in a safe and comfortable setting with other strugglers like me. See, I guess I always knew God existed and that he had the power to save me, but I never felt like I mattered to him. As a result, I never felt safe around religious people. Working through the Celebrate Recovery program helped me form a new and trusting and encouraging relationship with Christ that I never knew was possible. For a gal like me who spent many years feeling tossed aside and thrown away by God, learning that I mattered to him was a really big deal. The leaders and mentors at CR and at Grace Bible Church really helped me walk through this at a pace that worked well for me. The women of CR lifted me up, showed me how to pray and what to pray for, and they showed me how to have a relationship with Christ, something I never thought was possible for me. I'm now convinced without a doubt that not only do I matter to him, but he has shown me his power by saving me in every way possible. I have found freedom from my childhood church hurt, and I have forgiven those who harmed me in ways that I never thought would be possible. I'm approaching 17 years sober, but it's the last couple of years, my involvement with Celebrate Recovery, that have really had the greatest impact on the quality of my sober life. I am a new and changed person, and I know that each and every one of us matters to God. I am indeed a grace-changed life.
I don't know if you picked this up or not, but the one thing that Joni, that resonates with me is that this recovery process and this journey that you get in is really a spiritual growth process. It's sanctification. It's what God wants in all of our lives. And it begins with, first thing we talked about is that we acknowledge that God exists. Secondly, that we realize that what he's like, that we matter to him. And the third thing is, this is the last thing, that he has the power to help me recover. He has the power to help me recover. Now, I love this verse again. I want to go back to Hebrews 11 because it ends up and it says, and he not only that he exists, but that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And that's our part, is realizing that he has the power to help me recover. Philippians, the author of Philippians, Paul wrote something very similar. He said, for it is God at work within you, giving you the will and the power to achieve his purpose. The will and the power. And so really, it's just a matter of us asking God. It's this simple prayer that says, God, I don't know how to change. Like, I've done everything. I've done New Year's resolutions. I've read the self-help books. I've been to the classes. I've been to the groups. And I'm not getting anywhere. It's being willing to say, God, I don't know what to do, but I'm willing to be made willing to take that next step. I'm willing to be made willing. Maybe you would say, you know, yeah, like I've done all that stuff, but the desire to change hasn't been impacted by pain in my life yet. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And that's an option. It's not a good option. Because we know at the end of the day, those dashboard warning lights are going to go off, right? We're going to have those warning lights of conflict and frustration that are going to begin to go off. And just like in our car when they go off, you can ignore them. You can carry post-it notes and cover them all up. You can carry a tool bag like Eric talked about last week, like my tool bag is a hammer, and just take them all out. Then I don't have to worry about those dashboard warning lights. Or I can actually begin to lean in to this thing of recovery. 2 Timothy, Paul again, says this, that the Spirit that God gives us fills us with these three things: power, love, and self-control. And I don't know about you, but I have realized, as in principle one, that I'm powerless. I cannot do it on my own. I get angry that I get angry. I told you I have 60 days sobriety as of last Monday, meaning I haven't blown it again. That's tough. Recovery is hard. I keep blowing it, and then I get angry that I blow it. In fact, then I won't start a sobriety date again. I'll wait a couple weeks because I kind of just loathe in my anger for a little while, because I know if I start right now, I'm still dialed up. I'm probably going to lose it again. I will say what recovery has helped me do is it's helped me to make amends quicker. It's helped me to offer forgiveness quicker. It's put me back in a relationship and pulled me out of isolation. And that's part of what this journey does. And it's as simple as this. It's believing and receiving that God's going to give us that power. He's going to give us love. That's something that I've struggled with, both receiving and giving love. That's been hard for me. You compliment me, it just rolls away. Like, I don't even receive it, because compliments to me were setting me up for something else. Like, I'm supposed to do something now. And so I don't even receive that. That's just a part of my journey. I need love. I need power. And I need self-control. And it's as simple as asking God. It's this four-letter word. You can write this down, right, so you don't forget this. It's a four-letter word. Help. Help. What does it look like for you to recklessly abandon everything that you're holding on to, your desire to be in control, and say, God, I can't. I'm going to trust that you can, and wait for that miracle to happen. Surround yourself with a group of people who can hold you accountable to that change, that can work on that. Matthew says this in Matthew 17. He says, because of the littleness of your faith, For truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, just a little bit of faith, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it'll move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Doesn't take much faith. And by the way, faith comes from him, right? Like, I can't even work up faith. Even that comes from him. I'm even powerless when it comes to that. This principle is life-changing. It's the hope principle, and it simply says, earnestly believe that God exists, that I matter to him, and that he has the power to help me recover. Would you pray with me? Father, as we come to you, God, we just confess to you that we blow it. We blow it day after day after day. And God, even when we blow it just a little bit, God, if we're, your standard is perfection. That's why we need a Savior. And God, we have to admit that we're powerless. And God, today there's hope because we can recognize that, God, we matter to you. And that, God, you want to give us the power to recover from that thing we struggle with, whatever it is that we get locked up with in our mind, God, to recover from that and recover to you, our only hope. God, we just pray that you would give us the courage and the strength to take that next step. God, for some, maybe that next step is say, you know what, I'm not even on the journey. I don't even have faith in God, and I'm ready to take that step. I'm here today. I came just to explore, but I'm ready to take that next step. God, maybe that's what they need courage for. God, maybe they've been on the journey for a while, and there have been multiple people that have been telling me, man, I've got to do something different. My life is about to be unraveled, and they're ready to take that next step on the journey. God, whatever it is, give them the courage. In Jesus' name, amen.